Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 91. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and it's wonderful to have your company. As always, I'd like to begin by acknowledging and thanking the wonderful listeners who continue to support this podcast via Podbean Patron. This has been a challenging year for so many of us, including myself, so I'm deeply grateful for the generous support of my patrons. I'd also like to extend a heartfelt thank you to everyone who's taken the time to rate and review the show. If you love the podcast and never miss an episode, perhaps you'd consider becoming a Talking Tudors patron. It's easy to do. Just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family, and in addition to receiving lots of Tudor-themed goodies, you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. November's prize is a copy of The Birth of a Queen, Essays on the Quincentenary of Mary I, edited by Sarah Duncan and Valerie Schutte. A huge thank you to Valerie for sponsoring this wonderful prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about Tudor textiles is Aleri Lynn. Aleri is curator of the Royal Ceremonial Dress Collection at Historic Royal Palaces, where she cares for a collection of 10,000 items of historic dress and textiles dating back to Tudor times. She's the author of Tudor Textiles and Tudor Fashion, both published by Yale University Press, which aim to tell the story of Tudor dress and textiles at the Tudor court and explain their importance to the Tudor world. Tudor Fashion won the 2019 Historians of British Art Award for exemplary scholarship pre-1600. She's curated a number of exhibitions at both Kensington Palace and Hampton Court Palace, including 2019's The Lost Dress of Elizabeth I, focusing on the identification and conservation of the Bacton altar cloth. Previously, she worked in the Department of Furniture, Textiles and Fashion at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. My conversation with Aleri straight after this musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales.
Thank you.
welcome to Talking Tudors, Ilary. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's lovely to have you on the show. Now, I suppose a really good place to start is just by you introducing yourself to our listeners and just telling us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Ilary Lynn, and I'm the curator of the Royal Ceremonial Dress Collection at Historic Royal Palaces. So Historic Royal Palaces, the charity that looks after six Historic Royal Palaces, obviously. So we look after Hampton Court Palace, the Tower of London, also Kensington Palace, Kew Palace, the Banqueting Hall at Whitehall, and Hillsborough Castle. But of course, you know, Hampton Court and the Tower of London are two of the main stages where the Tudor drama unfolded. So it's a real pleasure to work at those two sites particularly.
What an incredible job. And I want to hear a little bit more about it. So you've mentioned that you're the Royal Ceremonial Dress Collection curator. Sorry, I should have said curator of the Royal Ceremonial Dress Collection at Historic Royal Palaces. So what does
it's all a bit of a mouthful.
It is a bit of a mouthful. I don't know how you get it out. You must have lots of practice. So what does your role actually involve?
So, I look after 10,000 items of royal and court and ceremonial dress dating back to the 16th century. And what that means is that's dress worn by members of the royal family, dress worn by the courtiers, and that can be everything from the sort of, you know, aristocratic best friends, you know, the very influential people, right down to the footmen and the servants who were also working on the backstairs of the palaces and things like that, but also dress that has been worn in the ceremonial traditions of the UK. So that's coronation robes, peers robes from the Houses of Lords and things like that. So it's a very specific collection, but it's a real pleasure to work with it actually, because the royal provenance tends to come with lots of really interesting stories. Right. So often dress collections can involve beautiful items of dress, but often, you know, unknown wearers or unknown makers. But the royal provenance means that people kept things and often documented things very well. You know, they often come with letters or photographs or descriptions, journal entries, that sort of thing. So it's a really rich source of information and storytelling. So it's a real privilege. So I should say, for the benefit of your audience, who I know are real Tudor fans, that we only have two things from the 16th century, which is a real shame, but not unusual. And that's because Tudor dress and textiles were valued so highly in the 16th century and even into the 17th century that they tended to get repurposed and reused and cut up and used over and over and over again. And so in many ways, they'd have been handed down until their provenance had, you know, was almost lost. And even if those dress and textiles had survived that period, they would have had to have contend with both the Commonwealth sale during the Civil War and then the Great Fire of London. So Tudor textiles are really fighting an uphill battle to survive.
Yeah, I live in hope that there's more hidden out there that we haven't yet come across. I'm sure there is in some stately home in the attic somewhere or something like that.
Well, this is the thing. I think that, you know, because these items were handed down and they were bequeathed in wills and they were reused, that actually a great proportion of the Tudor wardrobe is probably, you know, they're probably threadbare cushions in stately homes up and down, you know, the country. And that's where they are now. It's just the provenance is broken.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, earlier in the year, that was an exciting thing for you. Your book, Tudor Textiles, was published by Yale University Press. And so what kinds of textiles do you cover in your book?
I cover royal textiles, it's important to say. So what I try to do in my book, Tudor Textiles, but also in my previous book, Tudor Fashion, is really try and tell the story of textiles and dress within the Tudor royal court. So I'm not looking at the dress of working people or even dress and textiles outside of the court context. It's really about royal textiles and dress. And part of that was inspired by the fact that as curator of the Royal Ceremonial Dress Collection, it is my sad duty to inform people that no, they can't come and see the wardrobe of Anne Boleyn because, you know, it doesn't exist, you know, for all those reasons I just mentioned. So I wanted to try and fill that gap for our visitors. And the books seemed a really good way of telling those stories. So it's, you know, it's the dress worn at court by monarchs and, you know, and their court. And in Tudor textiles, it's the textiles that basically adorned the palaces. It's, you know, what would it feel like to be walking through the state apartments of Henry VIII, you know, his wives or his children.
Fantastic. And it's a beautiful book. I have had a look at it. It's really, really gorgeous. Yeah, absolutely. Now, you know, you've talked about the fact that these clothing and other textiles were so incredibly important and so valued. But can we dive a little bit deeper there? And can you tell us why they were so important at court and also what made them so valuable?
Well, there's a whole bunch of answers right there. And, you know, we should start probably first and foremost with the practical reasons. So the Tudor court had to move around a lot because, you know, the Tudor court comprised, you know, 1,000 people at any one time. And so wherever they went, they would quickly empty the larders and fill up the latrines. So they had to keep moving. And so textiles are a very portable form of decor. You can roll up a tapestry, chuck it in the back of a cart, take it with you and hang it up in the next palace. So it's incredibly portable and it provides warmth and insulation on those damp, cold walls, but also beauty and colour. So there's a very practical reason there, but textiles were really more than the sum of their parts. They became so much more than just practical decor. And, you know, they played such a huge role in the Tudor mindset and the Tudor way of looking at the world around them. And, you know, we shouldn't forget that Anne Boleyn's debut at court is recorded in a very modest textile receipt, for example. So in March 1522, there's a receipt for the pageant that she appeared in where she caught Henry's eye, right? And, you know, her debut is recorded in a modest receipt for yellow satin. And the ambassador's letters are full of records of textiles. So back and forth, you know, the ambassadors would write back to their princes and their masters, you know, the monarch appeared, you know, the king appeared wearing this, or the court was adorned with textiles and tapestries and cloth of gold. It's a way of projecting magnificence and wealth. Basically, it's sort of the ultimate status symbol in the Tudor world. And there are reasons for this. One is that in the Renaissance mindset, magnificence wasn't just a sort of excessive, frivolous thing. It was actually considered as virtue made tangible. So the more magnificent you were on the outside, the more virtuous you were on the inside. And this is really how the Tudors viewed the world. And, you know, this goes back, you know, into the previous century as well and into the later Middle Ages. So the more magnificent you are, the more worthy and deserving you are to rule. But of course, it is a great way of demonstrating wealth and really, really codifying your position in society. And the sorts of textiles that Henry would have had at his court really were out of reach for even most of the nobility. And that's because it was so expensive. So in 1509, when Henry, you know, when he became king, there's a receipt that says he paid just over £100 for just 18 yards of cloth of gold. Now, to put that into context, that's 10 years wages for a highly skilled labourer. So there's a vast gulf between what the king can afford and what most people can afford. And it must have seemed absolutely awe and terror inspiring in a way that the king could afford so much cloth of gold, so much tapestry woven with silk and gold and things like that. So it's a real power statement as well.
Yeah, I'm always amazed when I read inventories. I read one recently about the vine in Hampshire, and it was one done, I think, just from memory, I think it was roughly in the 1540s, early 1540s. And just the range and the you know, satin and velvet and the colours, like, I think it would have been quite a kind of, for our senses, maybe quite a shock to walk into one of these apartments and see all that colour and all those different textures.
I think that's a really good point, and it's one to remember actually when you're, when, you know, if you're able to walk into a Tudor palace or even a Tudor home, that what we see when we look at bare walls and wooden panels is very different from the way it would have looked in Tudor times. And it would have looked, as you say, really quite gaudy.
Yes,
because every bit, every surface that could be covered with textiles was covered with textiles, from tapestries to silk hangings. There was rush matting on the floor, but there were cushions strewn around for sitting on that were embroidered or woven. There were tablecloths. There were book covers were covered in textiles. And, you know, if you could afford them, carpets. So it was a very textile heavy space. And the more wealthy you were, the more colourful and the more pattern you could afford. So certainly if you step into a royal Tudor apartment, you would have been blown away by the colour and texture.
Yeah, look, I love the Tudors, but I also love muted colours now. So if you come to my house, you'll find lots of kind of nice muted colours. So I don't know how I do in the Tudor court. But let's talk about the privy apartments. Textiles obviously played a huge role in the ceremonial at court. So if we were coming for a little visit to Henry VIII's Tudor privy apartments, can you paint for us a little picture as to some of the different things we might see as we're walking through?
It's a good point to make that you're walking through. So let's assume that you are important enough to go into the privy apartments, because most people weren't. So as you step into the Great Hall, you're already privileged because you're in the first step. So the Great Hall of, say, Hampton Court Palace, you'd be surrounded by very dramatic tapestries with large biblical scenes. So currently in the Great Hall, you're surrounded by what we call the Abraham tapestries, which are many tapestries depicting the life of Abraham from the Bible. Now, these were actually commissioned for Henry VIII, and he commissioned them after the birth of his son. So, you know, they're dramatic, they're amazing, they've been there since Henry's time, and they are giving you a very clear message, because it's basically talking about the biblical passing of the covenant from father to son. So Henry's sending you a message about his divine right to rule. But as you go through from the larger apartments into the smaller apartments, into the private or privy apartments, you're only allowed in there if you are very important and if you have a special audience with the king. Now, bearing in mind that the Abraham tapestries were probably among the most expensive things that Henry VIII ever bought, they're woven with gold and silver. The textiles, as you go into the private apartments, are actually get more and more expensive, because as you get into the private presence of the king, the more influential you are, the more important you are. And so it's all about projecting the king's power and wealth to you as a very important visitor, and also the sort of influence that you might have. And so we know that the king's privy apartments were hanging with cloth of gold, adorned with pearls, embroidered in gold and silver. The tapestries got smaller because the spaces got smaller, but still very, very valuable. And even the bedchamber, which you would think would be a private space, was actually not. I mean, there was possibly nowhere more political than the royal bed, because that's where the heirs are made, right? So yeah. Anne Boleyn's bed, we have the description of that, and it sounds absolutely magnificent. So it's lined with yellow silk. It's trimmed with gold lace, known as Venice lace. It's made of cloth of gold, embroidered with her ciphers and Henry's ciphers, which were probably embroidered in gold and silver, and it's appliqued with red and green velvet, full of coats of arms and things like that. It's a symbol of her right to rule. It's a symbol of power. So even when you're in those privy spaces, it's all about projecting power. And I mean, I should say, what's interesting is in the privy spaces, you do get perhaps a sense of the king's personal taste a little bit more. So looking through the records, one of the things I've been able to find are references to the smaller tapestries. And those are the ones that probably were in the privy chambers. And there's lots of classical allusions there. So rather than these big biblical scenes or these big martial warring scenes that you'd see in the other rooms, here you have scenes of kind of lovers. So you have classical stories of Pyramus and Thisbe. You have kind of heroic classical heroes. So it's kind of nice to extrapolate from that Henry saw himself as a bit of a classical hero, which would fit the bill.
I'm sure he did.
Yeah. So that's quite interesting. And another thing, I guess, about the Tudor textiles in privy spaces is that you and your listeners may have heard about the fact that when the Queen went into her confinement to give birth, that she would, you know, be sequestered in her privy chamber, but that the space would be absolutely covered and wrapped around in textiles. So it was considered that fresh air was bad for you. And they wanted to keep fresh air away from the precious queen, which is, you know, just awful. But they basically would light a fire and they would cover the windows in tapestries and carpets, and they would cover the door in tapestries and carpets and the floors and the ceilings to absolutely envelop her. And one of the things that they specified was that the tapestries should not be too excitable in their depictions. So they should be verdures, which are sort of hunting scenes or woodland scenes, rather than battle scenes and things like that. So they didn't want to get her too excited.
Well, with all this sort of variety, all this amount of textiles at court, whose job was it to take care of it, to make sure there weren't any holes in the, you know, the cushions in the privy apartment and all that sort of thing?
Well, this is what I take great pleasure in, the fact that basically it was probably someone a little bit like me, not a woman, I have to say, but there was a huge administrative office called the offices of the Royal Wardrobe that encompassed quite a number of different offices that were a department of the royal household. So there was the department that made the clothes and looked after the stocks in of silks and different things that could be turned into hangings and clothes. There were also the administrators who looked after those stocks of clothes and tapestries and things when they were in storage, because there were so many textiles and items of dress that they couldn't all be used at the same time. So there were stores in the City of London, there were stores at the Tower of London, and different storehouses in each of the palaces called the removing wardrobes. And there would be a staff of people who would look after them. And the clothes and textiles would be wrapped in linen and laid on shelves or in trunks. And the officers of the wardrobe would light a fire every now and then in the stores. We know this because there are receipts for coal, and that would be to get rid of the damp. But we also know they did struggle with a problem of pests, because every now and then they had to take out the furs and the tapestries and beat them. And that was specifically, as it's recorded, to get rid of pests and vermin. So we know that there were pests, you know, bugs and potentially mice or rats making their home in the furs of the royal wardrobe. And so it was, I mean, it was a vast, vast administrative thing, because of course then you also had to arrange for the transportation of the textiles and dress from one palace to the other. And this could involve about 300 cartloads going from palace to palace at any one time. So really the Tudor bureaucracy was a well-oiled machine.
Yeah, incredible to just imagine that happening. I have been doing some research on the 1535 progress, which was one of the longest ones of Henry's reign. It lasted 3.5 months. And I'm just thinking, oh my goodness, just to get all that clothing and all those textiles moving for 3.5 months from place to place. And sometimes they were only at a location for, you know, a few days. Like I can't imagine the huge amount of work for those people.
No, absolutely. You're right. And there were sort of outriders who would ride ahead to make sure that the residence was ready and decorated. There were very strict instructions about how to decorate his room and to make his bed according to the way that he liked it. And just make sure, paying everybody as well. Oh. It was a massive organizational feat.
Massive organizational. Yeah, and beds, you've mentioned beds a couple of times. They were really valuable, weren't they? Because I know people left beds in their wills to people and things like that.
That's right, they did. And I think in this, in this day and age where we're very used to disposable fashion and to flat pack furniture, it's easy to forget how costly relative to income textiles, dress and furniture was back then. And certainly it was something that was handed down, generation to generation. And, this is the same even for the royal family in the 16th century. They were recycling and reusing as well. So we know that Henry's queens would often receive the wardrobe and the jewels of his former queen.
Yes.
Which, I mean, it's quite, you know, quite a symbolic weight to carry, isn't it? The jewels of his ex-wife around, around your neck.
Yeah, I often wonder how Jane Seymour felt when she inherited some of Anne's pieces. I just think,
wow. Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting thought. Now, you've spoken about how some people in the royal wardrobe made the clothing. So some people were in charge of making things. Did they also acquire things sort of ready-made? I imagine they imported a lot of stuff. Could you talk to us about how the things were acquired?
I mean, it's very complicated.
Yes,
and you know, there's lots of different avenues for acquiring things. So generally, in Henry VIII's reign, particularly, the fashion moved away from domestic products. So during Henry VII's reign, the court was largely wearing very fine English wool, but that's a domestic product. And in Henry VIII's reign, it moved very much towards importing textiles and dress. And this was, you know, largely only within the court. The rest of the population carried on wearing English wool. But the court wanted to wear fine Italian silks, and they wanted to have fine Turkish carpets. So imported things became the sort of must-have product. So there was lots of importing. Merchants were very, very important. So particularly the Italian merchants going, you know, from Venice and from different parts of Italy through Antwerp and the Low Countries into England. But the merchants held a really important role at court. They were very high status people because they were bringing in these luxury commodities. Yes. And often they would have audiences with, even with Henry himself, showing him the fine bolts of silk. And in fact, it was written into their contracts and their licenses that they were allowed to import on a certain, you know, payment of certain duties, which might be reduced if they brought the finest things to the king first.
Right.
So they would come, and often they would have a personal audience with the king, or if not, then with Thomas Cromwell, or, you know, the ministers, his kind of primary ministers. And we know that in Thomas Cromwell's to-do list, you know, in amongst sort of, you know, bills of attainder and, yes, you know, remember to execute this person, was also remember to show the queen the embroidery samples and things like that. So the merchants would bring the things directly. The job of the royal wardrobe was to try and anticipate what the king would need at certain times. So knowing that perhaps there might be, you know, hoping that there might be a christening or a wedding, or knowing that there might be a particular religious ceremony to observe, they would anticipate that, and they would buy in certain amounts of things in advance. So they buy in by bulk every 6 months, large bolts of silk and satin and wool and linen and things like that, and try and anticipate. But there was always that extra sort of surprise element if the king on progress happened to see something he liked, which we know happened. So sometimes the king would, you know, stop and say, oh, I'll buy some of that.
Yes.
as well. But largely it was the merchants coming in and selling directly, either, you know, to the king or to his advisors, and then, you know, settling up with the royal wardrobe who take it in and make stocks of it.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned Cromwell, because I suppose we don't often think of him as being somebody overly concerned with, you know, what they're wearing. But I have seen lots of records of people saying, oh, his many, you know, his many staff that he had saying, oh, we've got the, you know, the suit that you wanted, or the jacket that you wanted, or whatever he was getting at the time. So that's really interesting, isn't it?
It is. And this is the thing, that one of his many pies that he had fingers in was in the cloth business. He was a cloth merchant as well as many other things. And it really was one of the biggest businesses to be in. So the export and trade in silk and cloth and tapestries and things like that was incredibly valuable and important in the Tudor period. It was, you know, it was right up there with trading silver and you know, different, you know, kind of different luxury goods. And in fact, one of the main reasons for trying to expand into the New World, you know, when those kind of great voyages of discovery happened across the Atlantic, was actually to try and find new dyes, right, and new sources of, you know, to make cloth. It was, you know, it was really big business.
And also you mentioned the Italian merchants, which of course were quite privileged at court as well, as you said, having private audiences and all that sort of thing. I did read, I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that I think it was the Italian merchants that were the ones that were selling the cloth of gold or bringing in the gold tissue as well. So they, you know, very important.
Yeah, that's right. Because they were different sort of, you know, locations that specialized in different things. And the Italians had really cornered the market in fine silk, basically in silks and velvets. You know, it was considered that they had the best of that, and the cloth of gold was coming from Italy, so Florence particularly. And actually the merchants, because they were making so much money from the trade in cloth, they were one of, you know, they also became bankers and were able to lend money to the king. So it, you know, they became even more part of the kind of royal and court structure, but, you know, all linked around cloth. But yeah, it's, you know, those big names like the Medici and the Frescobaldis and the Cavalcanti, all of those big, big banking names were based on the cloth trade. They all had outposts in London and, you know, and were important enough to have direct audiences with, you know, members of the royal family.
Yeah, I'm just imagining Cromwell having an audience. You know, Cromwell was absolutely fluent in Italian. And so I imagine he would have, you know, spoken to the Italian merchants in Italian and negotiated. That would have been amazing to see.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I want to talk to you about a really exciting thing. Let me just introduce it for our listeners. So in 2019, a fragment of a dress that once belonged to Elizabeth I went on display at Hampton Court Palace. And you, Ellery, were instrumental in identifying this item, which at some point, and you've already mentioned how things were repurposed, at some point it was made into an altar cloth. And it was housed in St. Faith's Church in Bacton. So could you tell us about this incredible discovery and how you felt when you realized exactly what it is that you'd found?
It's a great story that's very close to my heart, obviously. So a few years ago, when I was writing Tudor Fashion, which was a sort of mini survey of extant Tudor dress, I guess, I was sort of aware, you know, of how very little royal Tudor dress actually survives out there. And it just so happened that one day I was looking online, you know, eating a sandwich and surfing the internet as you do. And I came across the website of a little church called St. Faith's in Bacton, Herefordshire. And there was a picture of, on the wall, a framed altar cloth that looked to me very distinctly 1590s. Based on the motifs of the botanical plants there. So I decided to go and have a look. And the moment I walked in and saw it, I knew that I was looking at something even more special than I had expected, because I was looking at a T-shaped object, which, you know, T-shaped to form an altar cloth. It would fall, basically a tablecloth that would fall down the sides of a table. But it was clear to me that it had been made from something else. It had not always been an altar cloth, because you could see the evidence of pattern cutting there. So it had been made from something else, and the pattern seemed to suggest that it had been made from a dress or an item of clothing. One of the next things that really blew me away was the quality of the embroidery. So most embroidery that survives from the 16th century is domestic embroidery. So that's, you know, done by amateurs, usually, well, in fact, invariably women of the household doing it as a domestic pastime. But this was clearly done by a very skilled professional, and it was done in silks and gold and silver of a standard that I had never seen before. And the other thing was that this embroidery was done on cloth of silver. Now, cloth of silver is silk woven on the loom with threads of real bullion silver. And the expense of it would have been remarkable. The amount of silver in this object would have cost as much as a very substantial Tudor house, to give it some context. But what is really important is that according to Tudor sumptuary law, which is a Tudor law that codifies what people can wear, the only people allowed to wear cloth of silver are immediate members of the royal family or the very upper echelons of court society. So your earls, your countesses, that sort of thing. So if you add all of those pieces together, it sort of leads you very directly to the Elizabethan court. And what was particularly exciting is that this little church in Bacton, Herefordshire, was the birthplace of one Blanche Parry. Now, Blanche Parry was a lifelong lady-in-waiting, mistress of the bedchamber to Elizabeth I. She had been with her from cradle almost to grave and was such a close companion and confidant of Elizabeth I that we know she was rewarded with gifts of clothing from the Queen herself as a sign of favour and affection. So all of that was incredibly tantalizing. So we took the object, not immediately, you know, after much negotiation and care, obviously, but we were able to secure a long-term loan of this object to Hampton Court Palace, where we spent a number of years researching it and conserving it to secure it for future generations, and then eventually putting it on display last year in the exhibition The Lost Dress of Elizabeth I. And you know, by that point, we were fairly confident we could claim it to be an item from Elizabeth's own wardrobe. And that being the case, it's one of, you know, the only, if not the only survivor from her wardrobe, apart from accessories like, you know, riding boots and gloves and things like that. But we were fairly certain that we could claim it to be an item from her wardrobe. All the research that we did pointed towards it being made for the very highest level of customer. And certainly at the point of her life that she would have worn it, we know the Queen was reserving the very best just for herself.
That's just an amazing discovery, isn't it? Such a fantastic story. I love it. I love it. And it wasn't uncommon for Elizabeth to give away her clothes, was it, as gifts to the to those most favoured courtiers or ladies-in-waiting, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's right. It was actually, I mean, it was considered a sort of virtuous princely act right through the Middle Ages to give gifts of clothing. But we know that Elizabeth did so quite regularly and frequently, and she would give gifts of her own clothing. And she particularly valued gifts of clothing to her. She let it be known that she liked gifts of embroidered dress and things like that. We also know that it came with prerequisites. Right. So she didn't like anybody to try to compete with her. So particularly, you know, when she reached a certain age in her life, but she did, for example, ban mirrors at court. Right. I think she got quite, one would say vain, but that makes it sound condemnatory. But actually, you know, I think, you know, she was the queen. Why not be a little bit vain? But certainly she didn't like it if people wore anything as nice as her. One lady-in-waiting, one Mary Howard, at one point tried to dress in quite fine clothes. And it might not have been helped by the fact she was also flirting with the Earl of Essex,
right?
which definitely put Elizabeth's nose out of joint. But Elizabeth, to punish her, went into her chambers and put on the offending dress, and then came back into her chambers and asked her ladies in waiting in turn, you know, what did she look like? How did she look? The problem is Elizabeth as a Tudor was very tall. Mary Howard was very short. It didn't fit her. It didn't look right. So the ladies, I can't imagine how frightened they must have been to say, you know, it doesn't suit your majesty or it doesn't fit your majesty, until she got to Mary Howard, who was so shamefaced and so ashamed. And she said, it does not fit your majesty. And then Elizabeth apparently replied, well, if it does not suit me, I'm sure it shall never suit you. And there we go. Mary Howard was put in her place. But the fact that we know she was reserving the very finest things for herself is an extra bit of evidence, you know, in favour of the Bacton altar cloth, because it looks very, very much like the bodice that the Queen is wearing in the very famous rainbow portrait. Now, the fact that it's fit for a queen at that point in her life, it means that it's unlikely that anybody else would have been daring to wear anything like it.
No, I don't think Mary Howard ever tried that again after that.
No, you wouldn't, would you?
And just something that just popped into my head. I don't know if you know this off the top of your head. I had read, I think once it was an ambassador's report, or read about an ambassador's report, and it was quite late in Elizabeth's reign. So she was, I suppose, at the, you know, for Tudor times, quite elderly by that time. Yeah. And that the ambassador was kind of shocked at how low cut her dress was, so much so that almost the tops of her nipples were showing.
Yeah.
Is that right? Was this how the fashion kind of the neckline got lower and lower?
Well, it's right, because it highlighted, I guess sort of quite surprisingly, it highlighted her status as a virgin.
Right.
So at that time, you were allowed to show your décolletage, your kind of bare skin, and have your hair down, only if you were a virgin. Right. So when you became married, you had to cover up. and to put your hair up, you know, in a hood or what, or a veil, or, you know, kind of hide it away. So the fact that Elizabeth continued to show her décolletage and to wear her hair down, even, you know, into her late 60s, you know, when, as you say, you know, in Tudor times, that was, you know, she was, you know, fairly elderly. But that was her highlighting her virginity. That's her, right, you know, in her symbolic role. So it's not risque or sexy. It's right, in fact, yes, saying that she's, you know, she is the Virgin Queen.
I don't know that the ambassador knew where to look, though. I feel for him. I feel for him. And another question, Larry, about the embroidery. You were talking about, obviously, there was lots of embroidery at court and in their privy apartments. And I know that obviously the queens and their ladies did this as pastimes, as you mentioned. Is there any evidence that the embroidery that they made was then on display at all? Would they have put it out in their apartments?
Yes, absolutely. So there's lots of evidence of that. So we know that, for example, Elizabeth herself embroidered book covers. She embroidered, I think, you know, there are two reputed survivors that embroidered by her herself as a young girl that she gave to her father. So gifts for Henry VIII. So that would have been out on display. We know that her half-sister Mary, Queen Mary I, liked embroidering cushions. So she liked to embroider cushion covers, which she would give as gifts. And certainly the embroidery done by the ladies in waiting would have been out on display, because often they ended up on items of dress, which were then, of course, worn. And one royal wifely duty was to embroider shirts. So we know that Catherine of Aragon, for example, would make and embroider Henry VIII's shirts. So royal queenly embroidery was on display daily, although that got Henry into big trouble one Christmas when Anne Boleyn realized that even though he had, you know, had sort of repudiated Catherine of Aragon, she was still making his shirts and he was still wearing them. And Anne got furious about this and absolutely stopped him wearing those embroidered shirts and said that she would now provide him with his shirts. But she didn't embroider them herself. Apparently she bought them. So I don't know whether she just didn't like to embroider. But so yes, absolutely, there would have been embroidery on display at the court.
When you were researching your book, did you manage to uncover any other sort of surviving articles of Tudor dress?
I did. And it's one of my favourite pieces, actually. So I said we have two items from the 16th century in our care in the Royal Ceremonial Dress Collection. One of them is the Bacton altar cloth, or the lost dress of Elizabeth I. The other is a hat called the Bristow hat. And this is a plum-coloured hat with a green ostrich feather in it and a silver braid button. And it's sort of made in a technique called thrumming, which gives the look of a very sort of long plush velvet. So it's quite a colourful, gaudy looking thing, really. But it dates from around the 1540s. And it's called the Bristow hat because it comes to us from direct descent from the family of Nicholas Bristow. Now, Nicholas Bristow was a keeper of the royal wardrobe. So he was one of those people that received in the stocks of silk and managed the goods and the, you know, the wardrobes and the transporting the tapestries and things like that. But the family legend, the Bristow family legend, says that it was in fact Henry's hat.
Wow.
The family legend says that during the siege of Boulogne in the 1540s, when the city fell, Henry was so jubilant he threw his hat up in the air. Nicholas Bristow caught it, and that's how it entered the family. Now, that's a lovely story and we cannot prove it, but what we do know is that it is a courtier's hat from the 1540s because of the silk and the dyes and the silver. It's an elite court hat. So even if it's just associated with Nicholas Bristow, that's still incredible. And as I said at the beginning, you know, these objects, they open up so many stories for us. Nicholas Bristow, you know, he's a fascinating character. And we have stories about him, such as he was one of the men responsible for going and emptying out Thomas Cromwell's house. Oh. When Thomas Cromwell was under arrest at the Tower, And one of Nicholas's roles was to take possession of prisoners' possessions. So he went and he basically looted Thomas Cromwell's house, removed the tapestries and the clothing and the, you know, different items. He took them by cart to Hampton Court Palace, where he handed them out to different courtiers. The king reserved Thomas Cromwell's robes of the Order of the Garter. And so, you know, we know that that was one of his duties. The macabre thing is that happened the day before Thomas Cromwell was executed. So if poor Thomas Cromwell was there in the tower hoping for a reprieve, well, it wasn't going to come because his stuff had already been divvied up and handed out by Nicholas Bristow.
The vultures descended very quickly in that time, didn't they? I'm just thinking about Anne's downfall and the other men, how even before their trials, people were petitioning for all their positions and all their wealth. Now, I have seen a picture of the hat and it is gaudy, as you say. I could just imagine Henry wearing something like that, actually. And there are pictures of it online. So if our listeners want to have a look, you can search that and you will find it. And maybe we can share a picture, Larry, if that's all right, of the hat.
Yeah, that would be absolutely fine. And one thing to say is that, you know, that the listeners might look at it and see, well, my gosh, the colors are so vibrant. And, you know, indeed it is surprisingly vibrant. And in fact, I had it scientifically tested because it's so surprisingly vibrant. And it does date to the right sort of time. But, you know, whether or not it belonged to Henry, the family believed it did. And so they kept it in near perfect conditions to ensure its survival. And so, you know, almost the legend is more, you know, is so powerful that we, you know, we really do have to thank it for ensuring the survival of this object.
Absolutely. Like if you said it was made last week, I'd believe you.
Yeah.
So it's an incredible condition. Now, two items, okay, from Tudor times, that's okay, but there are thousands of others in the collection, as you've mentioned. So what are a couple of your other favourites? It doesn't matter that they're not 16th century. What are your other favourite items in the collection?
So my favourite is the Bristow hat, because it was one of my very first acquisitions. And so it's sort of, you know, acquisitions that you make as a curator are very special to you. You know, they are dear to you. So that was something that I acquired on Christmas Eve of the first year that I worked at Hampton Court Palace. So it was a wonderful Christmas present. But we do look after items right up until present day. So we're able to tell really interesting stories of the palaces and their people. We have items belonging to, for example, Charles I, also William III. The Duke of Windsor's wardrobe is very fun. So the Duke of Windsor, who was Edward VIII, who abdicated to marry Wallis Simpson, well, he was quite a dandy and his wardrobe is suitably colourful and outlandish. We also have a very large collection of clothing worn by Queen Victoria and also by Princess Diana. So those items are particularly wonderful. And another reason, I guess, from the Bristow hat being the first acquisition I made, the most recent acquisition I made was the so-called Travolta dress worn by Princess Diana to dance with John Travolta at the White House in 1985. And that's a wonderful piece of design, a very beautiful dress that just sort of encapsulates a really sort of iconic moment in the life of one of our palace's former residents.
Wonderful. So many stories, you know, 10,000 items, 10,000 stories. So that's
absolutely.
It's incredible. Now, Larry, at the end of the Talking Tudors shows, Talking Tudor podcast, we always play what I like to call a little game of 10 to go. So these are just 10 quick questions just to get to know you a little bit better. So are you ready to do that?
This sounds like fun. Okay.
easy peasy. So what was the last film that you watched or show?
Oh, my God. Goodness.
I know that's
been, the last film that I watched, I'd like to say something very clever, but actually my I think in these crazy days I'm probably, like a lot of people, doing a lot of comfort viewing. And so actually the last film I watched was Hot Fuzz. If people don't know it, it's a British film, and it's a sort of comedy police buddy movie. Right. It's just a perfect bit of sort of police buddy movie meets twee murder mystery. I can't recommend it enough. It has me in stitches.
That sounds fun. I like it. That sounds good. And what is a book that is currently on your bedside table?
I have several. I'm reading several at the same time. So I'm reading Black and British by David Olusoga, which is a really wonderful book. And I am learning so much by reading it. There's, you know, some fascinating bits of history in there, and it's beautifully written. But I'm also rereading The Mirror and the Light by Hilary Mantel.
So rereading it, that's incredible.
Rereading it, but I can never read the end. I've never seen the last episode of Poirot. I love a murder mystery, but I can't watch the last episode, and I can't read the last chapter of The Mirror and the Light because I can't face, the execution. So there we go.
Yeah, well, you're doing better than me. I haven't been able to get past the first page yet. Not because it's not a fantastic novel, just because I don't want to see execution scenes either.
No, and also, it starts with the execution of Anne.
That's why I'm having a little bit of trouble getting in.
Yeah, so for you, that's absolutely. You close the book straight away.
I can probably get through the Cromwell's execution, but Anne's is going to be hard.
You should start halfway through.
Yes, I think I'm going to do that. Good advice. What about your favorite comfort food?
My favorite comfort food is definitely pasta.
Yes. Yeah.
Lots of pasta with tomato sauce, a nice Napolitana pasta.
Yummy. Excellent. And what about a treasured childhood memory?
Wow. These are nice questions. Treasured childhood memory. I guess one of the reasons that I do the job that I do is because I had so much fun as a child exploring castles with my family. So in Wales, where I grew up, we have more castles per square mile than anywhere else in the world. These are Norman castles, generally built by Edward I in the subjugation of Wales, which is, you know, a whole different story. But the ruins of these castles are beautiful and glorious spaces to explore. And as a child, being able to climb spiral staircases and turrets with my dad was just fun. So much fun. So, yeah.
And obviously we're not doing too much travel at the moment, unfortunately.
No.
But if you could, or when we're out there again, where do you think you'd like to go to next?
Immediately to Florence, please.
Okay. You knew that one straight away. Didn't have to think about that.
Absolutely.
That sounds good.
Well, I'm dreaming of my pasta in a sunlit piazza.
That sounds really good. And do you have any pets?
I don't. I am currently trying to fend off requests for pets from my small children.
Good luck.
So I've talked them down from a pony. We're perhaps negotiating on a guinea pig right now.
Okay, that's a guinea pig. Thank you. What about an ideal Friday night? What does that consist of for you?
Well, it's either going to a lovely late night opening at a museum, because Friday nights in London tends to see some great late night openings of a lot of our museums, and they tend to turn into really interesting, cool places where there are pop-up bars and pop-up events and really cool themed and curated evenings. So that would be me if I was being good and active. Otherwise it's a film on the sofa with a nice bit of food. But I think right now I'd give anything to go out and
that's right. First day
head into town.
Yeah, that's right.
It is for us, yeah.
Oh, no, goodness me. All right. And what's an inspirational place to visit that's close to your home?
So I work at Hampton Court Palace. And
lucky
when
duck.
I got the... I know. And when I got the job there, we actually moved as a family down to the area to be very close to the palace. And I have to say that, you know, even on my days off with the children, we will go to the palace. You know, even though I'm there Monday to Friday, it's a beautiful place to go. And I always see something new, even if I'm seeing it through the eyes of the kids for the first time. So it's just a wonderful place to be. It's beautiful. You know, it's got the treasures of the Renaissance world, but we put on great events there as well, which are so family friendly, and it's it's great.
Yeah,
it's my happy place.
Oh yeah, look, if I lived closer, I don't think they'd be able to get rid of me. So it'd be like, oh, she's back again. Oh my gosh.
That's me.
Crazy lady. Right, and lucky last, a memorable gift that you've received in your life.
Oh, that's a interesting question. I have a rock, it's not really a rock. I have a stone that I take with me from place to place. It's a small chunk of marble that my uncle and my aunt lived in Carrara in Italy,
Right.
and my uncle was a sculptor, and he would sculpt from marble. And so I have this chunk of marble that he gave me from the Carrara marble mines, and these are also the mines where the marble was found for Michelangelo's David, for example. So
Wow.
this is, this is a historic marble mine. Anyway, so I have this little stone of marble, a square of marble that is very unassuming, but is always on my desk and goes with me wherever I go. So it's yeah, it's my
That's
little bit of the
lovely.
Renaissance.
Yeah, I love that. That's beautiful. Now, the very, very last thing I promise, and then I'll let you get on with your day, is a Tudor takeaway. So I ask all my guests for a Tudor takeaway. And this is just something for our listeners to go off and explore after the episode. It might be a book or film recommendation or, an online exhibition to have a look at. Do you have a Tudor takeaway for us?
Yes, I
Yay.
do. If you can visit the Tower of London or Hampton Court Palace, for sure, because as I said, you immerse yourself in the Tudor world, and it's, they're wonderful atmospheric places to be, and much, much more welcoming than they were in the 16th century. But if you can't, if you're in a different country or can't make it to us right now, the curators at Historic World Palaces, we run a blog. And it's called White Gloves and Dirty Boots. And the reason the blog has such has that name is because we are quite an eclectic bunch of curators. We are sort of buildings curators and archaeologists, hence the dirty boots, and also collections curators like myself, so hence the white gloves. But White Gloves and Dirty Boots is a blog, and we all contribute to it. So we share, quite informally, just kind of updates about what we've acquired and things that we found out and nice bits of research that perhaps don't have a home yet, in exhibitions or books or journals and things like that. This sort of, hey, we've just found this, or this is what we've just acquired, or found out. So it's full of kind of nice stories, and I enjoy reading it as well to find out what my colleagues have been up to.
So that is a fantastic takeaway because I can tell you in almost 90 episodes, it's never been shared before. So
Oh, okay. Great.
thank you very much for that. I think we all need to go on and have a look at that. And yes, visiting the Tower of London and Hampton Court, there is absolutely nothing like it. And I've been lucky enough to visit London on many occasions, and I always go to Hampton Court and to the Tower, and I will continue to do so until I'm a very old lady.
Well, let me know when you are back and visiting.
Yes, I
We
absolutely
can
will.
meet up and have a cup of tea.
Oh, I would love to. And we can just go and pat walls and, just marvel at
Absolutely.
the
Well,
history.
come and see the Bristow hat.
Oh, yes, please. Absolutely. It's a date. It's a date. Aleri,
Excellent.
it's been so lovely chatting with you. And thank you so much for sharing your expertise and taking the time to talk Tudors with us.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Anytime.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is on the Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as the Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.